lot of batteries, yeah.
Yes, she agreed. Well, tonight was supposed to be a big test of the gateway machine, and...
And, he said quickly, you think something went wrong?
Abby paused for a long moment. Yes, she said, I think something went very wrong. Somehow that seemed to calm Castro, or at least steady him. Maybe it made him think of all this as merely a mechanical problem, a surge or overload. That fit into some version of a normal picture of the world. Abby didn't push it, because nothing she knew about the functions of the gateway could begin to explain that pulse, or its effect on the batteries and the emergency lights. The backup generators were on a completely different circuit and were heavily shielded to prevent any kind of damage from the gateway process. The same went for cell phones. How could a test firing interfere with cellular service? But that was an irritation compared to the overwhelming horror of what might have been done. Dr. Jacqueline Sloan was at Gateway. Despite all the spin control to the contrary, Sloan had been more than a mere advisor at Fukushima. Abby's mouth went dry, and she could feel her heart hammering on the walls of her chest.
Right,
Castro said, looking around, clearly focusing on the immediate problem and not catching Abby's fear at all.
We better get you out of here so that you can help.
He paused and looked at her.
You can help, right?
Abby managed to smile despite her shrieking nerves. I built that machine, so yes, I'm pretty sure I can help.
Cool,
said Mike. He jabbed at the controls, got nothing. Then he tried to force the doors open. They were too well made by security-conscious engineers. Where are we, do you think? Asked Abby. Castro looked up.
We were pretty far up when that pulse thing hit. Maybe 54 or 5. Could even be higher.
There's a reset closet on 57, she said. I think we can at least get the lights back on.
That's a good start, said Castro. There's a ladder running along the inside of the shaft. I can get up and pull you up.
I think I can manage, she said. My boyfriend's a fitness coach, and he uses me to try out new routines.
David, yeah. He's ex-military too, right? And climbs mountains and shit. You climb with him?
Mountains? No. I'm actually the sane one in the relationship.
But you work here, he said.
It wasn't much of a joke, but it helped. With Abby helping to steady him with a hand gripping his utility belt, Castro climbed up onto the metal handrail and popped one of the ceiling panels up. The frame was reinforced for just such an emergency, and he used it to chin himself into the opening. Abby pushed his feet up, and then he was on the roof of the car, extending a hand down. Abby put one foot on the rail and pushed, leaping up so fast that Castro had to fall backward as she caught the lip of the opening and swarmed up beside him.
Well, damn, Doc, he said. You're buff as hell.
Deep core makes you hardcore, she said.
Wait, he's that David? David Bailey?
Castro laughed.
Hell, I downloaded a couple of his workouts.
They stood and looked up, using her phone's flash to orient themselves. There was a door about 9 feet above them. The number 55 was stenciled on the inside.
Easy climb, he said, tapping the ladder. Let me go first to open the...
His voice trailed off. What's wrong? She asked. But then she understood. She could smell what was wrong. There was smoke several stories above them, a billowing cloud of it that was almost lost in the shadows. Tendrils, trapped with nowhere to go, slithered down the wall toward them.
Something's burning, said Castro,
his newfound calm slipping a couple of notches.
But the sprinklers aren't on. That makes no sense. They have battery backups and the whole system is gravity fed by the tanks on the roof.
Jesus, breathed Abby. We need to get up there. And I mean right now. Chapter 26. The Pierce Tower, ground level. David Bailey woke into a world of pain and confusion. Before he even opened his eyes, he spoke a word, a name.
Abby.
There was silence, and he blacked out again. For a few moments only. Then he was aware that he was awake and in pain. He did not move immediately, trying to feel inside his body for damage, not wanting to have a sudden movement exacerbate anything. He opened his eyes, blinking to try to clear the darkness of concussion, but he was not concussed, and the darkness was real. His head hurt the worst, and he understood that. He could feel blood in his hair, but there was a sharp pain in his lower right side, and for several confused seconds, he wondered if he'd been shot. Then as he became more fully awake, he realized that it was the socket of the seatbelt. The belt itself had somehow become unlocked, and he was leaning half over toward the passenger side, onto the latch end, where the metal tongue was inserted. Whatever hit him must have thrown him against the driver's side glass, and then the shock rebounded him toward the other side. "I'm not hurt," he told himself, mostly believing that to be true. David pushed himself very slowly to a sitting position, wondering vaguely why the airbag hadn't deployed. Then he realized it had, but had already deflated. His practical mind sought to recall the data about airbags. A mechanical switch is flipped when there is a mass shift that closes an electrical contact, telling the sensors that a crash has occurred. The sensors receive information from an accelerometer built into a microchip. The airbag's inflation system reacts sodium azide with potassium nitrate to produce nitrogen gas. Hot blasts of the nitrogen inflate the airbag in 1/25 of a second. He tasted a powdery substance in his mouth and knew it was cornstarch, used to keep the bag pliable when stored in the steering wheel. Thinking this through, the orderly process and mechanism steadied him, as such practical analysis always did. It was one of the mind tricks he and Abby shared, pragmatist in an often impractical world, imposing logic on chaos. "I'm not hurt," he thought again, forcing himself to accept that as a truth. He jerked the door handle open and got out very slowly and carefully. The world spun around, but it wasn't as bad as he expected. No double vision, no ringing in his ears. He wasn't nauseous either, which made him confident he didn't have a concussion. Dented, not damaged, he told himself. The cold rain helped a lot, washing his eyes and waking him up. He held onto the door, though, letting his legs regain their strength as he slowly looked around and froze there. The last of the traumatic fuzziness burned off, and everything became crystal clear, horribly clear. All of the streetlights were dark, and he could see that the ones closest to him were damaged, the lenses destroyed and the bulbs shattered. Most of the cars on the street sat askew, as if shoved by some petulant giant child. Three of them were on their sides, and one lay upside down like a dead turtle. Beyond that, though, the lights of Times Square had gone dark, yet there was plenty of light. He walked away from his car to get a better look, and his mouth slowly fell open. There were fires everywhere, dozens of them, close and far away. Pillars of gray-black smoke curled up toward the storm clouds, pushed skyward by the raging flames of dying buildings. Thunder boomed overhead, making him flinch, and in the accompanying lightning flashes, he could see that some of the buildings, even the ones not burning, were damaged, with shattered windows and huge gashes running down story after story. Some looked misshapen, as if their top floor had somehow been torn away. "Oh my God," he breathed. There was so much damage, so much rampant destruction that he didn't even know how to think about it. What caused this? Was it a bomb? A terrorist attack? Then he turned to see those fires reflected in the reinforced glass windows of the Pierce Tower. It startled him to see that those panes were still intact, or mostly. A few showed cracks, but none had actually blown out, and the building was not burning. "Abby," he said, then dug his hand into his pocket for his cell, desperate to call her. There was no service. Nothing. David frowned, trying to make sense of it. He used to be a soldier, a special operator, filled with lots of specialized knowledge. His first thought was that something like a nuclear bomb had dropped, That would explain some of the damage, the extent of the devastation. The resulting EMP, electromagnetic pulse, would have knocked out the power. Except that his car's engine was still running, and despite the lack of service, his cell was operational, nor was there a mushroom cloud rising to challenge the storm. He thought of alternatives, like a fuel air bomb, which was the most powerful non-nuclear weapon in existence. But there would be even more fires, and they would be clustered around the impact point. Nothing that he knew about, with all of his extensive knowledge of the machineries of warfare, could explain this. He ran to the building, splashing through the rainfall, wobbling less and less with each step as his muscles shook off the trauma of the crash and adrenaline shot into his bloodstream. However, the doors were not merely closed and locked. A heavy steel shutter had dropped in front of them. "Shit," he snarled. He ran along the side of the building, but the other entrances were equally blocked. David stopped and walked backward, peering up at the tower. Behind each of the glass windows was a slab of gray, and that he did understand. The building had very sophisticated security, and as a reaction to that weird pulse, it had gone into a hard lockdown. He backpedaled all the way to his car, then went around and popped the back, where he always kept a go bag of essentials. He rifled through power bars, a flashlight, water, a foil blanket, a small tent, a first aid kit, some tools, and found his pair of compact but very powerful binoculars. David slid them from their case and trained them on the tower, moving slowly upward, side to side, checking every window. They were all shuttered. When he got to the top floor, though, he saw that he was wrong about that. There was a row of windows that was neither shuttered nor intact. They'd been blown outward, and he thought he saw the faintest flicker of yellow. "Almighty God," he breathed. The building was on fire. So far, it wasn't bad, and maybe the internal sprinklers were on, but... He whirled and ran back to his car, slid onto the seat, pulled his lock knife from his pocket, and snapped the blade into place. It sheared through the airbag, and David tossed the material aside. He slammed the door, put the car in gear, and stamped down on the gas. The car was dented, but it drove straight and true, and he accelerated so fast that even with the rainfall, he burned a 20-foot patch of melted rubber behind him. Chapter 27. The Pierce Tower. Between floors. Mike Castro climbed first, and Abby followed. "Hurry," she called. But Castro was already moving as fast as he could, and soon he reached the 57th floor. There was too much smoke roiling around the 58th to risk it. Castro stepped off the ladder onto a narrow metal service ledge and turned to help Abby up. She put her hand on the inside of the door and breathed a sigh of relief. "It's not hot," she said. "The fire must be contained to 58. Castro grunted.
"That's something, at least."
The Pierce Tower elevators had double doors, and like most such devices, the inner doors in the cars were much harder to open than the ones to the floor itself. Castro fumbled to get his fingers into the narrow cleft between the doors, managed it, then braced his feet, and funneled his considerable muscular strength into the act of pulling. Abby saw his big back expand as he worked it. It took a lot of effort, but he was a powerful man, with fear and desperation driving him. The door opened a quarter inch. Abby clamped her teeth around her cell to keep the light steady and stuck her fingers in to hold the space while Castro adjusted his grip. Then, together, they pulled the doors open partway.
"Can you get through?" grunted Castro.
"I think so," said Abby. She wriggled past him and curled herself around the edge of one door. It was tight, but she managed it and was soon in the hall. Then she turned, fitted her back against one door, and pushed on the other with both hands. That did the trick, and the door opened all the way. Castro and she fell into the hall, but they disentangled and shot to their feet. The 57th floor was mostly industrial, with batteries and turbines sending power up through the floor to the gateway machine above. Normally, there was a constant low hum of restless energy, but now it was completely silent.
"Where is everyone?"
mused Castro. His hand rested on the butt of his pistol, as if a malfunctioning machine was somehow a culprit he could detain. On any other day, Abby might have been amused and even chided him about it. Not today, though. The gun was a link to Mike Castro's feelings of personal security, and she didn't want to disturb that process. In an odd way, her cell phone, even though only the flashlight function was working, was hers. Abby shone the light around, and they both grunted at the same time. There was a crack in one of the walls. It ran from floor to ceiling and was wide enough for Abby to stick in her little finger.
"God damn," said Castro. "Do you think the building's compromised?"
Abby shook her head. "I don't know. Right now we're seeing a crack in plaster. Doesn't mean the building's bones are cracked. Besides, Pierce Tower was built to withstand the kind of thing that happened on 9/11. I think we're good." The big man looked dubious.
"I hope that's the only one."
"So do I," replied Abby. "Come on, let's find the electrical closet. It's near the stairwell." They followed the light of her cell phone down the hall, and Abby saw more cracks, but didn't say anything to Castro. For all his size, he seemed to be a bit nervous. She could relate. Everything about today was pushing her to the ragged edge of her ability to cope. "There it is," she said, pointing to a gray metal door at the end of the hall, opposite the entrance to the fire tower. "Mike, do you have a pass key?"
"I got you,"
he said, and fished on his key ring for one, with a yellow lightning bolt on the triangular head. He reached past her to open the door, and they entered. The closet was 8x8. With large industrial circuit breakers in neat rows. Abby found the master reset button, pressed it, and then began shoving the circuits, each one with a rubber red-coated handle. The system responded with comforting efficiency, and the lights came on. She heard the cha-chunk of the air conditioning kick in, too.
"We good here, Doc?"
asked Castro. Before Abby could reply, there was a massive, heavy whomp that shook the whole building. It was so loud, so forceful that it knocked them off their feet. Even as Abby fell, even as her senses were assaulted by the noise and shock, she knew what it was. Another pulse, another monstrous pulse from the gateway machine, like the one that had turned the whole building dark. Before the last shudders ended, Abby was on her feet and running for the stairs. But just as she reached for the handle, the door suddenly whipped open. A figure stepped out. Disheveled, flash-burned, with torn clothes and blood running down her face and arms, the figure took three tottering steps and then crumpled to the floor.
"Rosa!"
screamed Abby. Chapter 28. The Broken City. David Bailey drove through madness. Through fire and panic, abandoned cars were everywhere, and twice he had to slow down, nudge his Jeep up to a vehicle, and then push it out of the way. It crumpled the fenders of the Jeep and smashed one headlight, but he managed it and kept driving. He tried the radio, but there was nothing. Tried his cell, and it was still dead. All around him, people were wandering like zombies in the street, their eyes glassy with shock and confusion. Their bodies streaked with blood and clotted with dust and bits of debris. The rain turned the dust to mud, making each staggering victim look like they'd only just clawed their way out of a deep grave. He saw a cop standing on a corner, his pistol held in one hand, but not aimed anywhere. The officer's mouth open and eyes filled with too much for him to process. 10 feet away, a woman sat on the pavement, her back to the wall, hands clamped over a face that was nothing but a red nightmare. And across the street, two teenagers were filling a metal shopping cart with stuff they were looting from a Duane Reade pharmacy. Both of them were stark naked and covered with dozens of glass cuts. Both of them were laughing, despite the hammering of the frigid rain. The city had gone mad. And maybe more than just the city. Nothing made any sense. David could not understand why his car engine still worked. A few other cars were moving too, and here and there he saw a building with working lights and a few street lamps still glowed. Why? That made no sense. A catastrophic failure of electrical systems should have knocked everything out. So why were random lights and engines working?
What happened up there, Abby?
He asked the night. Then, having said her name, a wave of sick fear punched him in the gut. He whispered,
"Please be okay."
He reached his apartment building and almost wept with relief to see that it was not burning and not destroyed. There were even some lights on in the lobby, though as he got out of his car, he saw that all the lights on one half of the building were out, while the others still burned. David bolted for the lobby, which was clogged with confused people jabbering on the edge of hysteria. He pushed through them, caught a glance at the elevators, and dismissed it as too risky. Their apartment was on the 10th floor, so he ran to the fire stairs and began taking the steps two at a time. The unit he shared with Abby was on the lighted side of the building, a small mercy. He opened the door and hurried over to the landline. It was working, but when he dialed Abby, he got a recorded message saying the number was unavailable. He tried the Pierce Tower front desk, but there was no answer at all. Rosa Rodriguez's phone went straight to voicemail.
Shit,
he growled. He tried 911 and got a recording saying that due to a heavy call volume, the anticipated wait time was 90 minutes. He slammed the phone down.
Shit, shit, shit.
Then his cell phone suddenly rang. It was so unexpected that it made him jump. He tore it from his pocket and saw that it was his sister, Caitlin, who lived over in the Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn. He punched the answer button.
Caitlin, he cried. Are you okay? Are the kids okay?
But there was no answer. Not a voice, anyway. Instead, he heard a sound like wind howling across a beach and the desultory crash of slow, heavy waves. There was a noise like some aquatic bird, a long and plaintive cry that was not a seagull or pelican.
Caitlin, where are you?
The sound of waves continued for a few more moments, and then another sound swallowed it up. It was not a bird and not a human voice. No, nothing at all like that. It was a bellow of raw need, of hunger, perhaps. A howl. No, a roar. It was too big, too loud, too immediate to be made by anything that made sense. It was bigger than a mere roar, deeper and angrier. And then it was gone. David held the phone to his ear and strained to hear, but now even those strange and unnatural sounds were gone. No waves, no wind, nothing. He lowered the phone and stared at it.
What the hell is...
Before he could finish that sentence, something heavy thumped against the window in the living room. He hurried over and, to his horror, saw that the big glass pane was cracked. A jagged piece, the size of a dinner plate, had been knocked from it, and cold, wind-driven rain slanted through the opening. He approached cautiously, trying to understand what caused the damage. Something dark glistened on the teeth of that hole, and he edged carefully toward it, praying the glass didn't shatter completely. The smear was dark and vicious, and a bead of it ran thickly down to the cracked pane. At first, he thought it was oil of some kind, and then the lightning flashed bright white, accentuating every color in the room, turning the oily blackness to bright red. He caught the smell then, that distinctive sheared copper aroma of fresh blood. David stumbled backward until his legs hit the arm of a leather chair. He fell backward onto the cushion, bounced out, and wound up on his hands and knees. He remained there, freaked out beyond thought, for 3 full seconds. And then he was up and moving. He ran to the closet in his workout room, found his heavy canvas gear bag, then began pulling items out of the closet. If Pierce Tower was on lockdown, then there was only one way in, that broken window high up. And what was a building, after all, than just a mountain, shorter than many he'd climbed? 58 floors equaled about 650 feet. A piece of cake for someone who'd climbed El Capitan in Yosemite, Ketu in Pakistan, and Kanchenjunga on the border of India and Nepal.
"I'm coming, Abby,"
he said aloud as he turned toward the door. But then he stopped and glanced at the blood on the window. What the hell had struck the building hard enough to break glass as tough as that? Even a big bird driven by the storm winds couldn't have done that. Not even a turkey vulture. So what had? And what was the roaring sound over the phone line? What in fact was happening everywhere? David felt his face tighten as his old combat senses began to push away his shock and reassert control over his body and his mind. He went back to his bedroom, opened the closet again, and dialed in the combination of the gun safe. He removed his 6-hour 226 pistol and weighed it in his hand. Then he stripped off his windbreaker and slipped into a nylon shoulder holster that had 2 slots for 2 extra magazines. He slapped a full magazine into the weapon and racked the slide to put 1 in the pipe. Then he was running for the door. He got all the way down to the street and was dashing for his Jeep when the second pulse hit the city. Chapter 29. The Pierce Tower, 57th floor. Abby knelt by Rosa, lifting her head and cradling it on her lap. Her friend was not unconscious, but teetering on the very edge of that long drop. Abby checked her over quickly, while a confused and alarmed Mike Castro stood watching, his hand still resting on the butt of his holstered automatic.
"Is she okay?"
asked the big guard.
I think so, said Abby. "She has some cuts and burns, but nothing seems to be broken. She's not bleeding badly."
Rosa moaned and turned her face toward Abby's stomach, nestling there the way a frightened and sleepy child might. It was both touching and alarming. Rosa was a smart, capable, and intelligent woman.
"What happened to her?" asked Castro. "You think that gateway thing blew up? It would explain a lot of this mess."
"It can't be as simple as that," she said. "I designed Gateway, and there's nothing technically combustible about it. Power overload shouldn't be possible, not with all the buffers and redundancies engineered into every aspect of it."
That had been a key element in her initial presentation to Congress a few years ago. She'd argued that a worst-case scenario for Gateway would only be something like a power failure, not a destructive surge like whatever those pulses were.
"Well, Doc," said Castro, "something damn well blew up."
He walked to the fire stairs and opened the door a few inches, then paused.
"Hey, should we be thinking about some kind of sabotage or terrorism?"
Abby didn't respond to that. She had her own suspicions, but Rosa was starting to come out of it. Rosa's eyelids fluttered open, and she looked around, frowning, as if confused about what was happening.
"Abby?" she murmured. "It's okay, Rosa," said Abby. "You're okay. You're safe."
At those words, the younger woman came fully awake. She uttered a sharp cry and sat up. Abby steadied her and watched her friend look wildly around.
"Oh my God, Abby," she cried. "It's all so.
She stopped and shook her head, unable to finish.
"Stairs are clear," said Castro as he came back to join them. "Not too much smoke, and I'm not feeling much heat. I don't think it's a very bad fire. Maybe they have it under control. We should go up."
Then he noticed that Rosa was awake.
"Oh, hey, you okay?"
Abby touched Rosa's shoulder.
"What happened here? Can you tell me?"
Rosa took a few steadying breaths and then nodded.
"They brought her in, that witch, Dr. Sloan. God, Abby, how could Benjamin be that stupid? I mean, after Fukushima, who in their right mind would hire Jacqueline Sloan to operate anything more sophisticated than a toaster oven? She's a maniac."
"Benjamin let her do the test firing?"
Rosa shook her head.
"I mean, that's what he told everyone. But then the turbines began cycling all the way up. When I saw the readings, I rushed upstairs, thinking it was some kind of accident, an overload or a system control failure. Benjamin didn't want me there, but by then it was too late for me to do anything anyway. And it's not like he even listens to me. I'm just a worker drone to him, and a lot less than that to Sloan."
She grabbed Abby's sleeve and held tight.
"Sloan was at the controls. and I could see both keys had been plugged in and turned. Christ, Abby, they really did it. Instead of testing the system, they just... Her voice was rising to a hysterical pitch, and Abby tried to soothe her. "Can you tell me what happened?" she asked. "Was there a power surge of some kind? We felt those energy pulses. What was that? Did the system overload or blow out?" Rosa stared at her with eyes that were filling up with remembered horror.
"Abby, no," she said in a hollowed voice. "You're not listening.
They fired the gateway at full power."
"I understand that," said Abby. "But what caused it to crash?"
"Listen to me," cried Rosa. "The system didn't fail."
Abby stared at her.
"Wait, what?"
"I'm telling you," Rosa said with rising desperation in her voice. "The gateway machine is still on. They established a threshold."
"No," breathed Abby. Then despite everything, she had to ask. "How long did it hold?"
"Why don't you listen?"
wailed Rosa.
"It's still open."
"What?" Tears broke from Rosa's eyes and rolled down her burned and bloody face.
"The threshold is open, Abby."
Abby got to her feet, dazed, and took a few wandering steps toward the fire tower.
"It's open? God almighty, we did it. We actually did it."
She turned back sharply. "And it's been open all this time? It's stable?" Rosa got up too, hissing with pain.
"Stable," she echoed, then spat out a bitter laugh. "Abby, that threshold is open, but it is not stable. That's what I've been trying to tell you. They did it wrong. They did something wrong. They should have tested it. That's what you've been telling Benjamin all these months. That's what you tried to tell that senator. The whole point of the test fire was to find out what would happen when we established a threshold. We should have had all hands on deck, reading and collecting that data. Instead, dickhead Benjamin brought in his pet witch, and they just said fuck it to every common sense thing you ever said. I heard Sloan calling you a coward and a failure for being too careful. She said you were wrong, and history would laugh at you. She was telling Benjamin how their gateway was going to change history, that it was going to save the world. Their gateway. Christ!"
"What happened, though?" demanded Abby. "Why are we in lockdown? How'd you get hurt? None of this makes sense." Rosa wiped blood from the corner of her eye and looked at it. Because of her tears, the blood was pink and thin.
"I told Benjamin I called you," she said.
"What did he say?" But Rosa just shook her head.
"Rosa, what did he say?"
Rosa raised her brimming eyes.
"He said he was glad. He said that maybe you could save us."
"Save who?"
"Save all of us, Abby," she said.
Rosa held her arms out, and Abby couldn't tell if she was indicating the people there in Pierce Tower, or the city, or the world. Abby looked at her, and then at Mike Castro. His handgun was halfway out of its holster.
"Holy shit," he said.
Abby felt an icy hand close around her heart. Above them, they heard another whoomp, and they braced as a third pulse burst outward from the gateway. Or outward from the threshold, which was much, much worse. There was the risk of pollutants and other dangers, insects, radiation, who knew what.
"I have to get up there," she snapped, and headed for the stairs.
God, she thought, please don't let me be too late. Chapter 30. The Broken City. The second pulse was not as bad as the first. It was 100 times worse. David Bailey felt it coming and wrapped his arms around a lamppost, burying his face against his shoulder like a weary boxer trying to avoid that final crushing blow. He squeezed his eyes shut, not wanting to see what he heard. There was the sound of metal screaming as it bent. The cracking of bricks was like madmen emptying whole magazines of steel jacketed rounds. Asphalt groaned in pain as it was torn open. And the screams. Dear God, the screams. People in sudden terror.
People in ungodly pain. People praying. People dying. All around him. And the actual pulse? That was the strangest feeling David ever experienced. It did not hit like a physical blow. It was more like standing waist deep in the ocean surf as a towering wave rolled over him. There was no specific point of impact. It simply was. He felt a pull like a tidal surge lift him, and for long moments he was stretched out like a flag, his feet kicking in the air. He was screaming, but he couldn't hear it, and yet he could hear a child wailing halfway down the block. Madness. All of it was madness. And that quickly, it was over. David collapsed down to the ground, still hugging the pole, gasping, battered, alive, still alive. He lay for long moments. When he opened his eyes, he thought he was blind or crazy. Above him, far, far above, there were stars. So many stars, and not one single cloud. Despite the rain that still ran down every vertical surface, despite the fact that mere seconds ago it was pouring, nothing. The massive storm was gone from the New York skies completely. Taking the lightning and thunder, the wind and rain with it, it was as if it were a different sky from a different place, which was, of course, completely impossible. "The world's gone nuts," he said aloud, not meaning it as a joke. David climbed to his feet, holding on to the pole until he was sure his legs would take his weight. Twice now he'd been battered, and he still had to reach Abby, to climb the outside of a skyscraper. He wasn't at all sure he had enough left to do it, though he knew he had to try. He straightened and looked around. There were bodies everywhere, not running or hiding or even calling for help. There were corpses smashed against overturned cars, heaped over the fangs of broken windows, torn to pieces and scattered like discarded dolls. He didn't know how many. 40? Twice that? And how many more that he could not see? A man in a business suit, completely uninjured in body but fractured in mind, stood in the middle of the street, fists clenched, screaming at the night. "What's happening? What's happening?" Over and over again. David felt like joining him. What was happening? What process of logic or method of analysis could make sense of what he saw around him? Some of the cars, including his Jeep, stood upright and undamaged, whereas others had been crushed to metal lumps. A few of the buildings that had been burning before no longer were, but surely no firefighters could have doused those infernos, and other buildings had burst into flames. The pulse had caused the damage, but how? He was not the scientist in the family. Whatever this was, it was positive. Started at Pierce Tower with that first pulse. And if anyone could make sense of it, that person was Abby. He looked around for his gear bag, saw that it was wedged into a corner between a building and an overturned Toyota. He staggered to it, pulled it free with some effort, and then headed for his Jeep in an ungainly run walk. He tossed the bag into the back seat, started the engine, and nearly wept when it roared to life. Then he spun around and raced back to Pierce Tower. He was not screaming a question at the sky like the man in the street, but he kept repeating Abby's name over and over. Chapter 31. The Pierce Tower. 58th floor. Abby raced up the stairs, with Rosa and Castro right behind. There was some smoke, but it wasn't thick, and strangely, it didn't smell like melting wires or burning plastic. Those were the only flammable parts of the gateway machine. Everything else was made from metal or crystals. For one terrible moment, as she neared the top of the stairs, she was terrified at the thought of what else might be burning. People, after all, were also flammable. Horror rose like bile in her throat, and she gagged. But then the sensible scientist part of her brain clamped down on that thought. There was no cooked meat stench, either. No. In fact, the smoke was strange. It smelled organic, like grass or weeds. an oddly autumnal smell, like barrel fires after a day of raking leaves when she was a little girl living down south, and yet there wasn't so much as a potted plant in the gateway chamber. She reached the top landing but paused to press her palm against the metal security door, feeling for heat, finding none. The metal was actually cold, very cold, which, like so many things, made no sense. The ambient temperature in the stairwell was around 70 degrees, but the door was so cold it numbed her fingers. Castro and Rosa caught up with her. "Is it hot?" Castro asked. Then he blinked, because as he spoke, his breath plumed with steam, like speaking aloud on a frosty morning. "What the?" He didn't bother to finish, and Abby did not try to explain. She glanced at Rosa, whose brown face had turned the color of spoiled butter. Strange lights glittering in her dark eyes, like tiny fireworks of raw fear. Abby steeled herself and turned the handle. The door moved toward her as if pushed by a wind. Castro drew his Glock and took it in both hands, but kept the barrel pointed down. "It's only a malfunction," said Abby, but Castro kept his weapon ready. Abby took a breath and pulled open the door and stepped into hell. Chapter 32. The Pierce Tower. The Climb. David saw that the lights in Pierce Tower were on, not all, but some, and that was encouraging. He pulled his Jeep up to the side of the building where he'd seen the broken window, got out, and ran to the door, but it was still shuttered. There was no answer when he pushed the buzzer. He tried Abby's cell again, got nothing.
"So,"
he said aloud, "stick with plan A." David fetched his gear and began preparing. He swapped his cross trainers for a pair of climbing shoes. They were close-fitting with no padding and had sticky rubber soles. Next, he put on sturdy leather belay gloves, which augmented his grip and would also protect him from friction burns if he had to rappel down. The helmet he buckled on was lightweight but durable, and he clipped an LED light to it. He had long coils of very tough, lightweight kern mantle rope, which was constructed with its interior core protected by a woven exterior sheath that optimized strength, flexibility, and durability. He put on a harness that jingled with carabiners and quick draws, belay devices and descenders, and other critical gear. He didn't have fancy suction cups or other stuff for climbing glass, but even a building like Pierce Tower, which was predominantly glass-fronted, had little ledges and niches. He'd climbed sheer ice walls in Antarctica that were less accommodating than this. He paused for a long moment, taking many slow breaths, forcing his body to calm down, which in turn helped quiet the raging terror in his mind. He turned his thoughts away from the ruin of Times Square and the other parts of New York he could see and focused on this.
"I'm coming, Abby," he said. "You hold on because I'm coming."
And he started to climb. Chapter 33. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. The gateway chamber was a bizarre tableau. The monstrous machine stood there in its glory, polished steel and gleaming copper, sparkling gemstones and glowing lights. It hummed so deeply that the air around it shimmered like a mirage on a hot desert highway. Dr. Arnold Benjamin stood by the main control panel, his palms flat on the machine, eyes wide, mouth open, an air of madness about him. All around him were monitors and sensor arrays that had clearly exploded, scattering jagged bits of metal everywhere. A few yards away, like the last desperate passengers on the tilting deck of the Titanic, two of them were badly injured, probably from exploding debris. Someone had tried to stanch their wounds, but the blood still ran. Abby's other lab assistant, a graduate student named Connor, looked at her and paused for a moment in the act of applying a dressing to another tech who was completely unconscious, his chest and face deeply lacerated. The others stood like terrified sheep, clutching each other, staring at something Abby could not see. Closer to where Abby stood was a tall woman, Dr. Jacqueline Sloan, in a lab coat stained with ash and streaked with blood, as if she'd stood in the path of an arterial spray. It glistened as it ran down to drip from the coat's hem onto the floor. Her hair was in disarray, and there was a profound look of shock on her face. On the floor were pools of glistening liquid, oil of some kind, water, something green that smelled of frogs and rotting vegetation, and blood. Sloane stood in a lake of it. Her stockings were soaked with it, way too much of it. If all of it had come from that mangled tech, then he was in real mortal danger. Abby noticed that Sloane was missing one of her shoes. The vulnerability of that was somehow both endearing and frightening. The tableau held for a long moment. Infinite time compressed into a cracked fragment of a second. Then Abby stepped farther into the room and turned to see what they were all looking at. The opening of the gateway machine. It was no longer a yawning black mouth. Now it was ablaze with light, ringed with it so brightly it was as if the light was melting into the metal frame. The glow was nearly too bright to look at, and Abby shielded her eyes and squinted under her hand to see. Beyond the frame of that entrance was not the inside of the machine. Smoke coiled out of it like snakes, bringing with it that smell of burning leaves. Fire licked up through the smoke. But beyond the smoke and fire was another world. There was a vast sky of a blue so dark it was nearly purple. There were trees, broken, snapped off, burning, standing impossibly tall in a field of grasses Abby could not identify. They were similar to what had been recorded by the TMI Gateway probe, but they weren't the same. Insects buzzed and flitted through the grass, but as they neared the fires, they burst into flame and then popped wetly. In the distance, a pair of massive shapes moved, gray like elephants, but draped in long and matted hair. Their huge heads were fitted with titanic tusks, but they were neither mammoths nor mastodons. There were far too many eyes in those hideous faces, and the writhing trunks were sheathed in spikes. And above them, the moon was a swollen white blister on the sky. No, it was a moon. Two others, either smaller or more distant, were just visible above the far line of trees. Abby stood with her mouth open and her mind divided into two completely separate reactions. On the one hand, people were hurt and the pulse had damaged the building. But on the other, she was staring at a completely stable threshold. This was not a video imagining of what one would be like, and it wasn't the maddeningly brief archival footage from Three Mile Island's probes. No, she was standing there, looking through her machine into the landscape of another world, another version of Earth, a vastly different one. Then the utter horror of it slammed into Abby. She was smelling the trees and grasses that were burning on the other side of the threshold. That should have been impossible with all the filtration she'd engineered into the gateway. Smell is particulate, which meant that particles were flowing freely between that world and this one. Anything in that air, viruses, bacteria, fungi, exotic pollens, was now flowing through the gateway chamber. She wheeled furiously on Benjamin. What have you done? He stared at her and through her, clearly unable to see anything except that glowing threshold. His lips moved, but no sound came out.
We saved the world,
said a voice, fragile and shocked, broken and small. Abby turned toward Jacqueline Sloane. The older woman's hands were shaking badly, as she tried to push and pat her hair back into the stylish coiffure it had once been. But each movement was awkward, fumbling, and she made it worse. Tears ran from her eyes, taking clumps of mascara with it. Between the pallor of her skin, the black smudges around her eyes, and her too bright lipstick, she looked like a very tragic clown from a minor opera. Abby wanted to comfort her and strangle her.
What did you do? She demanded,
as Rosa and Castro came up to flank her. Sloane gave her a smile that was as brittle as fine porcelain.
"We opened the way,"
she said, but there was no emphasis, no real focus. It was as if she was speaking, but not to anyone.
"We opened the way to the worlds. We opened the door to all the worlds."
"You goddamn idiot!" yelled Abby, as she hurried over to the control console. She read the information on the screens and dials, and her heart sank as all of it confirmed her worst fears. "You never properly tested the filters and BAMs. You fired the gateway without proving that the filters would sync up with the threshold. Can you smell that? We're breathing the air from the other world. You could have killed us all." Sloane's vacuity seemed to harden for a moment.
"What do you know about anything, you cowardly little bitch? History isn't made by timid women."
"Stop quoting your page-a-day calendar at me," Abby fired back. "Rosa, help me shut this down. God, I hope we're not too late." Benjamin drifted toward her like a ghost.
I initiated the lockdown. I saved the world."
Abby wanted to punch him in the throat. "Oh, shut up, you imbecile. You brought her in here. You gave her my key. You were so damn concerned about the oversight committee that you forgot everything you knew about scientific protocols, about process and common goddamn sense." She shook her head.
"Jesus, and to think I admired you all these years. You were my mentor, Arnold. You were my hero. And now, God, you've shown who you really are. A coward, a greedy fool, and a disgrace."
Arnold Benjamin stopped where he was, shocked at her words.
Who do you think you are? You can't talk to me like that. I...
"Just shut up and stay out of my way," said Abby. "You've done enough damage." Benjamin seemed to summon a shred of dignity, and he swelled and stepped toward Abby, reaching to prevent her from touching the controls. But then Mike Castro stepped between Abby and the boss. Benjamin was taller, but Castro's chest and shoulders seemed to fill the room, and he still had his pistol in his hand. It didn't matter that the barrel was pointed at the floor.
"Maybe dial it down a notch, Doc," said the guard.
Benjamin's eyes flared.
"Get out of my way, or I'll have you fired."
Castro smiled thinly.
"You can't fire me. My company is subcontracted by the Department of Defense. I don't work for you. I'm here to protect this building and the people who work here. And right now, it's my professional assessment that you and Dr. Sloane are posing a threat. Please, sir, don't make me insist."
Sloane and Benjamin immediately shifted their anger from Abby to Castro and began yelling at him. That was fine, because it allowed Abby and Rosa to work. None of the huddled technicians came to help, though. They were either too traumatized by what had happened, and Abby still didn't know the extent of it, or were afraid of the damage to their careers if they defied Benjamin. Only Connor took a wary half step forward, but then he froze, uncertain what to do next.
"Rosa," said Abby in an urgent whisper, "take that key and let's turn both of them together."
"That will cause a hard shutdown," cautioned Rosa. "It could damage the gateway engines."
"Kinda don't give a damn at this point. We need to stop that airflow, and we can't reset the system and get the scrubbers online while there's an active threshold. Ready? Good. 3, 2, now."
They both twisted the keys. Or they tried to. The heavy metal keys did not budge, not one bit. Abby and Rosa tried again and again.
"Oh, shit,"
breathed Rosa, her face registering even more shock.
"The hard lockdown," gasped Abby. "Benjamin locked everything out. We're going to have to reboot the whole network from the backup control room down on 20.
"I'll go," said Rosa. She whirled and ran for the door, but Abby called after her.
"Restore controls, but don't open the shutters."
"Got it."
And Rosa made it almost all the way to the door when the next pulse hit.
Chapter 34. The Pierce Tower. The Climb. David reached the 20th floor and paused to catch his breath. He balanced himself precariously on a narrow ledge that divided that story from the one below. There were extremely thin cracks in the concrete into which the heavy shuttered windows were set. Too narrow for a standard piton, so he fished out a Lost Arrow version. These were specialty pins that had saved a lot of climbers since they were designed in 1940. The blades were extremely durable and fit into thin cracks that were too small for a standard angle piton. He managed to seat it very snugly in place and attached a line from it to his harness. 1 second later, the pulse exploded outward from the Pierce Tower. It came right through the walls and plucked him off his perch, flinging him out into the night air. David shot to the end of the line, felt it stretch to its maximum length. He did not cry out to God or beg for mercy. Instead, he roared Abby's name. And the Lost Arrow held. The slack swung him back toward the building, and he took the impact on the balls of his feet, bending his knees and flexing his thighs to take the shock. He needed all of his core strength to keep from having the air punched from his lungs. David scrambled to get back onto the narrow ledge and clung there, gasping and trembling. "Climb, you silly bastard," he told himself. He did not look behind him to see what terrible damage this latest pulse had wrought. He wasn't sure how much more of it he could take. "Just climb," he said. "Abby needs you. Climb." And so he climbed. Story by story, while behind him 1,000 sirens tore the night. Police and ambulances, car alarms and burglar alarms. Buried beneath that din were the screams. So many screams. "Climb," he growled. And then something struck him hard on the left shoulder. Once more he was torn from the wall, and once more the piton saved him. He thumped back against the glass, hissing in pain, looking around wildly for what struck him. At first, he thought it was debris from above, but his mind replayed the blow, and he realized it had come from the side. A heavy, glancing blow. David hung from the rope and turned to look around. The night was full of fire and smoke as the city burned. However, the smoke closest to him swirled and eddied from where something had passed through it. "What the hell?" he wondered. And then he saw it. It. A shape. A shape came sweeping toward him. It was huge, bigger than any bird. Much, much bigger. And as it turned in a slow, wide circle to come back toward him, David could see that it was not a bird at all. Birds have feathers. Birds have beaks. Birds do not have 20-foot-wide wings of leather. Birds do not have gaping mouths filled with row upon row of razor-sharp teeth. Not even in books of flying reptiles from the age of dinosaurs had David ever seen a monster like this, and it did not belong in any sane version of the world. The creature let loose with an ungodly and unnatural cry as it swooped toward David, reaching for his flesh with claws and with those awful teeth. Chapter 35. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. This last pulse was so much bigger. The power of it snatched every person in the chamber up and hurled them like leaves in a blast of autumn wind. Sloan and Benjamin collided with Mike Castro, and they went sprawling into the puddle of blood. The technicians were scattered like pieces of straw. Abby saw one of them smash, face forward, into the curved wall of the gateway machine, and then sag to the floor, leaving a smear of blood flecked with broken teeth. Rosa never made it to the door, but was instead tossed into a bank of computers. She fell heavily and crumpled down, completely unmoving. Abby was thrown away from the control console and sent skidding to the far wall, which she hit with shocking force. The lights in the room dimmed. Or maybe it was her own mind teetering on the cliff edge of consciousness. She tasted blood in her mouth. Everyone was hurt,
Everything was falling apart. This is all my fault, she thought. I didn't build it right. I must have made mistakes. It's all my fault. The air was filled with the smells of another earth. They were all breathing it in. It didn't matter that Benjamin had put the building into shutdown. It didn't matter that he and Sloan had bypassed testing and tried to beat the congressional axe by going straight to full threshold. None of that mattered. She'd built this thing. And now it was all falling apart. This was hers. This was all on her.
I've killed us all, she thought, and it made her want to scream.
She heard someone calling her name from a million miles away, and Abby, gasping, coughing, spitting blood to clear her mouth, tried to answer. For a weird moment, she thought it was David. But no, he was downstairs, safe in his car, probably worried out of his mind. Would David have called the police by now? Knowing him, yes.
Abby?
The voice yelled again. She blinked and raised her head. It felt like jacking up a truck. She saw Connor, a dozen feet away. He was on his hands and knees. But even though he was calling her name, he wasn't looking at her. Abby turned her head, an action that hurt because there was something wrong with her neck, and followed his line of sight. He was looking at the gateway. No, he was looking into it, through the threshold. Abby stared too. It no longer showed that grassy field and the big animals. The three moons no longer hung in the sky. This was another world altogether, another earth. There were towers of green crystal rising to a sky filled with pale ships that floated like clouds. Banners waved from the tops of each tower. Then it was gone, instantly replaced by a primal swamp in which things, newly evolved, legless and eyeless, flopped around in puddles of green water. Something like an obscene tongue rose out of the water and coiled around one of the creatures. And with a flex of hideous muscles, it burst it, crushed it, and pulled the dying thing beneath the surface. That image vanished, and there was the same field of green grass from before. But as she watched it, it grew from little sprouts to tall weeds, which then withered to yellow and brown before disintegrating into dust as snow fell. That happened over and over again in an endless cycle, as if time in that earth ran so much faster. Soon the green field was a barren and lifeless stretch of red-brown dirt. Another earth appeared, with a small city where the towers had stood before, but this city was under siege by a vast army of armored creatures with too many arms and no trace of humanity about them. The city burned and died as Abby watched. It vanished, and there was another earth, and it too was dying, as strange plants grew recklessly and wildly, choking each other and crushing the life from small, mutated and deformed animals that sought to escape. More earths appeared, flashing into view within the threshold. 5, 10, 50, hundreds. It was like a madman had a TV remote and kept switching, never lingering. In every case, the view was from the same approximate place, as if the gateway accessed a specific spot on these infinite worlds. As she watched, more and more of those worlds seemed to be damaged, dying. And much of that destruction seemed to move outward from the point where the threshold peered into that reality, as if its presence was somehow causing an infection to those infinite earths. Smells issued from the threshold, filling the chamber with the scents and stinks of rot and violence, of death and twisted life. Small clouds of insects and bits of burning debris were vomited into Abby's world as the machine throbbed and pulsed and the fabric of reality was violated. And then, something else came through. It was not an insect or some random animal. It was not a stray bird or a seed pod. It stood erect, a biped, but so strange. dressed in some kind of armor that glistened like the chitinous shell of an insect. Suddenly, Abby remembered the description of the artifact recorded by the TMI probe. A piece of greenish-brown material, curved and sturdy, like maybe it was processed metal or maybe plastic. That's what this was. It was armor. The thing stepped from another world into this world. The armor covered it from head to toe. It wore heavy boots and gloves, and a helmet with no features except two eyes that glowed with a malicious yellow light. Devices were slung from the thing's shoulders and waist and clipped to its thighs. It carried a kind of club, a dark golden brown, 3 feet long, with an ornate head on one end and a sharp dagger point on the other end. Behind it, things moved. At first, Abby thought they were dogs, but they moved like cats, slinking low to the ground. Their eyes were feline, but each had reptilian skin and claws that left deep gouges on the concrete floor of the chamber. This thing, this warrior, made a sharp clicking sound, and the creatures clustered around it like dogs to a huntsman. Connor, who was closest, got to his feet, his hands up, palms out, in a calming, pleading gesture.
"Hey, hey," he said. "We don't..."
And the club moved. So fast, a blur of dark gold that suddenly seeded the air with rubies. That's what it seemed to Abby, for a moment. And then the truth of it, the horror of it filled the whole world as Connor's body fell sideways, blood shooting from the stump of his neck, his head, eyes wide, mouth forever trying to finish what he'd said, struck the floor and rolled toward Abby. Abby screamed. It was torn from deep in her chest, and it abraded her throat as it exploded out, filling the room. The creature turned toward her, fixing her with those yellow eyes. She saw it recoil from her. The pack snarled and hissed as they crouched at the hunter's feet. It raised the club and pointed the blade, still dripping with Connor's blood, at her.
"You," it said.
In English. Abby's scream died in her throat. She froze, unable to move, to think. The creature's voice was deep, but female.
"You,"
repeated the hunter as she stepped forward one single threatening pace.
"You, mother of none, destroyer of worlds. You, murderer of infinity. You, hated among all women who have ever lived."
"No," cried Abby as she backed away. She slipped in a puddle of blood and fell hard onto the floor. "What are you talking about? I...
"You are Abigail Corman," said the hunter, taking another step. "You are the goddess of death, and I am here to tear your heart from your chest and lay it on the grave of my world, of all worlds."
End of part one. To be continued in Bewilderness. What Rough Beast.
This has been an Audible original, produced by Audible Originals, written by Jonathan Mayberry, performed by Shayna Small, executive producers Steve Feldberg and Joy Smith, acquisition and development Louise Quayle, vice president of Audible Studios Mike Charzik, editor-in-chief Audible Original Publishing David Blum. Copyright 2020 by Jonathan Mayberry Productions, LLC. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.